I want to welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Psychology Forum of the Commonwealth Club. We are really honored to have Elizabeth Zitron speak for us tonight. She represents Death Penalty Focus on the Steering Committee of the World Coalition Against the Death Penalty, which is an international coalition of over 100 organizations in 35 nations on five continents. She chairs the World Coalition's working group in the United States. Her brief in that capacity is to build bridges and develop a collaborative strategy between the U.S. death penalty abolition movement and the international abolition community, which includes the great majority of the world's governments. Elizabeth was chosen by her World Coalition colleagues to represent them at the opening ceremonies of this year's Fourth World Congress Against the Death Penalty at the United Nations in Geneva. She spoke there in the company of heads of state, ambassadors, ministers of justice, but they only gave her 6 minutes, and she has a lot of material saved up for us here at the Commonwealth Club in her own city, hometown of San Francisco. So please welcome Ms. Elizabeth Zitron.
Okay, hello everyone. Thank you for being here. I want to thank Patrick O'Reilly and this historic forum for the free exchange of ideas, the Commonwealth Club, for inviting me to speak with you. Before plunging headlong into the very serious subject of the abolition of the death penalty in California, in all of the United States, and throughout the world, a word about those of you who are here for the more beautiful part. No surgery is involved. No fat-free cheese, no light beer, no sugar-free cookies. In addition to more beautiful, I offered you safer, richer, and smarter, and we'll start there. The death penalty is supposed to make us safer. Isn't that the point? Isn't that how they sell it to us? I'm tough on crime. I'll demand the death penalty. But does the death penalty make us safer? Or would we be safer if we were smart on crime rather than just talking tough? How might we imagine that the death penalty could make us safer? Well, it gets rid of a killer. Well, it probably gets rid of a killer. Or, well, maybe it gets rid of a killer. Okay, so maybe it gets rid of a killer. But why maybe? So now we're going to do a few numbers. So if you need to write them down, this is the time. Out of every 1,000 intentional homicides committed in the state of California, the state with the broadest and most inclusive death penalty law in the country, about 100 are prosecuted as death cases. Out of those 100 death prosecutions in California, that's cases where the district attorney asks for death and prosecutes the case as a death penalty case, less than one. That's less than 1% of death penalty prosecutions and 0.1% of intentional homicides committed in the state of California actually results in a sentence of death. And for those, the average time on death row in California from sentence to execution is now around 24 years. So the death penalty actually prevents almost no one from committing more crimes. The next time you hear a politician or a political candidate say, "I'm in favor of the death penalty because I'm tough on crime," remember this. When they say the death penalty is a deterrent, remember a few more things. If you forget, email me. That's my email address, ezitron@deathpenalty.org. And I'll send you the cliff notes. There's been a lot written about the death penalty and deterrence of crime over the past several decades, and probably before. Last year, in 2009, an authoritative study by University of Colorado at Boulder, professor and chair of the sociology department, Michael Radlett, and Tracy Laycock, who was a graduate student, surveyed the current and past presidents of the top academic criminological societies in the United States. For those of you who like to think in those terms, these are not the bleeding heart liberal ACLU and criminal defense types. these are the FBI Crime Stopper types, you know, with short hair and skinny black ties and all that. 77 of them. The study was published by Northwestern University School of Law's Journal of Criminal Law and Criminology, so you can read it for yourself. Here's what they found. 88% of criminologists do not believe that the death penalty deters murder. Here are the numbers. 88%. 88% of criminologists do not believe that the death penalty deters murder. 87%. 87% is the percent of criminologists who do not believe that abolishing the death penalty would have a significant effect on murder rates. 75%. 75% is the percent of respondents who agreed with this statement. Debates about the death penalty distract Congress and state legislatures from focusing on real solutions to crime problems. In other words, the death penalty is not a real solution to crime problems. Okay, so 88% of those skinny black tie, short hair criminologists do not believe that the death penalty deters murder. What, you may say, about the other 12%? I can tell you about 9%, and it's really interesting. 9% of the criminologists believe that death penalty states had lower homicide rates than other states. I'll say it again. 9% of the criminologists believed that death penalty states had lower homicide rates than other states. You know why that's really interesting? Because it isn't true. And what is true is another really clear indication of how we know that the death penalty is not a deterrent. The American South, which accounts for over 80% of executions in the United States, has, according to the FBI, the highest murder rate in the United States. The Northeast, which accounts for less than 1% of executions, has the lowest murder rate. The death penalty does not, by any measure, deter murder. Before we leave Professor Radlett, let's take a step back to those numbers at the beginning. Remember, 1,000 intentional homicides, 100 death prosecutions, less than one death sentence. 0.1% of intentional homicides result in a death sentence in California. And here's what Professor Radlett says about deterrence. The deterrent effect of a punishment is really an effect of two things, severity and certainty. And it turns out that certainty is a more effective deterrent than severity. 0.1% is not even close to certainty. And we'll come back to Professor Radlett because he's a nice guy and he likes to have his name mentioned. And this idea one more time, so you'll have another chance. Okay, so I said before that maybe the death penalty gets rid of killers. That maybe was partly because there is so little certainty in the death penalty. Another part of that maybe is that in the United States of America, the greatest democracy in the history of the world, a nation whose criminal justice system is built on the concepts of fairness and justice and equality before the law, where everyone gets a fair shake and justice is blind and we're all innocent until proven guilty and we're entitled to a zealous defense and an honest truth-seeking prosecution. In the United States of America, in that United States of America, the America we all believe in, we get it wrong shockingly often. Since 1976, 139 people have been exonerated from death row in the United States. That means that 139 people have fought red tape through red tape and obstruction like you wouldn't believe. The most powerless people in the country, mostly poor, disproportionately minorities, convicted of the most despicable, horrible crimes, they found people on the outside to fight for them, to spend their own money, to go to court, to write newspaper articles, and generally to climb Mount Everest in order to prove their innocence. Everything we know indicates that there are many more innocent people condemned to death, and we don't know how many innocent people have been executed. One thing we do know for sure is that death is different. There is no going back, no apology, no reunion at the prison door. Anyone here, including the Commonwealth Club, was interested in hearing some of the extraordinary in-person stories of death row exonerees at your neighborhood club or your synagogue or mosque or church or school or pretty much anywhere, let me know, ezitrin@deathpenalty.org, and I'll help you arrange it, and it will change the life of everybody who hears it. So, we're still on safer, and we're moving rapidly to richer, which may be even more important to some of you than more beautiful. What does prevent killers from killing again? If it's not the death penalty, what do we do as a society that wants to be safe? Let's look, then, at the more effective and more successful alternative to the death penalty. Lock them up and throw away the key. The alternative is permanent incarceration. That's known also as death by incarceration or death in prison. More formally, it's known as life without the possibility of parole. And here's what I'd like you to remember about this alternative to the death penalty, permanent incarceration. Since it became law in California in 1973, close to 40 years ago, which will make you either feel very old or very young, depending on where you are on the spectrum, almost 4,000 people have received this sentence, life without the possibility of parole. And not one single one of them has been released without being exonerated or cleared of the crime. Not one. Permanent incarceration, life without parole, definitely keeps us safe. But safer? Safer. And that brings us to the richer part. You may believe, you may read, you may hear, that we should not be coddling the worst of the worst, the child murderers and the serial killers and all the grotesque monsters who commit the most heinous crimes. I agree. We shouldn't be coddling them. Why, you may ask, should we spend our hard-earned tax dollars to keep them alive and well-fed with free medical care and a basketball court and cable TV? Let's just save all that money and kill them and be done with it. That's what you believe, you have a point, but you may lack some information. A couple of years ago, in 2008, a California State Bipartisan Commission chaired by John Vandekamp, who had been the elected district attorney of Los Angeles County, our largest county, and the elected attorney general of the state of California, the highest law enforcement officer of the state, that commission released its report on the fair administration of justice in California, and their findings were stunning. They found, now these are half those prosecution types, these are not, you know, short hair cops. They found that the death penalty system in California is completely dysfunctional and very, very expensive. They found that it costs $137 million per year, $137 million every year. That's for the broken system with all that delay that doesn't work and screws up and has the terrible backlog and 24 years and inadequate counsel. They found that that $137 million per year is $125 million per year more than permanent incarceration. $125 million every year over and above the lock them up and throw away the key option, from which no one has ever been released in the state of California. The lock them up and throw away the key option that provides us with both more certainty and safety. And they found that the needed reforms to start to improve the system would cost an additional minimum of $95 million more per year on top of the $125. All that plus the $400 million that Governor Schwarzenegger has proposed to spend on a new death row. So here is the richer part. Over the next 5 years, at $125 million per year that we can save by replacing death by execution with death by incarceration, that's $600 million. Add to that the $400 million that the governor wants to spend on a new death row, and we can save a cool $1 billion over the next 5 years by stopping death prosecutions, using the alternative of permanent incarceration and commuting existing death sentences to permanent imprisonment. And you know what the guy said? A billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon you're talking about real money. So that's where that number comes from. Now, before we move on to smarter and more beautiful, I want to go back to safer for just a minute, because safety, I think, is really what we expect from the criminal justice system. Remember back when Professor Radlett was talking about deterrence. I'm going to read you the rest of what he said. The deterrent effect of a punishment is really an effect of two things, severity and certainty, and it turns out that certainty is a more effective deterrent than severity. In Colorado, where he works and teaches, if we wanted to reduce the homicide rate, we would spend our money solving some of the 14,000 homicides that we know have not been solved. Anything we can do to increase the certainty of apprehension is a much better deterrent than taking people we already know are going to die in prison and spending millions and millions to determine the date and time of their death. And that goes in spades in California. In California, from 1999 to 2008, 46% of homicides were unsolved. That's over 12,000 killers walking the street just for that 10-year period. And for the previous 10-year period, there was a similar number. As bad as that is for the state as a whole, almost half of all homicides unsolved. It's worse in some counties. In Alameda County, across the bay, where Berkeley and Oakland and a lot of other places are, for that same 10-year period, 61.5% of homicides were unsolved. Unsolved. And still, Alameda County, with threats to close their hospitals, close their parks, with their schools in receivership, has continued to make very generous use of the death penalty. Los Angeles County, which in 2009 sentenced more people to death than all of the nations of the world, except for five, which sentenced more people to death in 2009 than Texas, failed to solve 54% of their homicides in that 10-year period. More than half of the killers from Los Angeles County for that 10-year period are still out on the streets. From just those 10 years, 1999 to 2008, over 12,000 killers are walking the streets of California. How much crime prevention and crime solving do you suppose we could do with that extra $1 billion, that $125 million a year? One of the many things we could do with that $125 million a year is hire about 1,500 experienced homicide inspectors. And real quick, then, we get to smarter. Another of the many things we could do with that $125 million a year is hire about 1,900 experienced school teachers. That's every year. And so to beauty. Your mother might have told you that true beauty comes from within and from a feeling of well-being, peace and serenity, and knowing that you're doing the right thing. The United States of America, proud of its commitment to fairness and justice, is being left behind on one of the most important international human rights issues of our age. We are way behind the curve. We are surpassed in human rights by, most recently, Togo and Burundi. The U.S. has a worse record on the essential human right to life than Turkmenistan, Ukraine, Liberia, Mexico, and Rwanda. And those are only a few of the nations that have left us in the dust just in this century so far, the 21st century. In 2009, only 18 nations on the planet executed human beings. This great nation is in that small, shameful community. To be precise, we placed number 5, behind Saudi Arabia, but with more state killing of people than Yemen, Sudan, Vietnam, and Syria. China executed more than all other nations combined last year, but they are just the leader of a club that we should not be proud to belong to. We're in bad company on death sentencing, too. We ranked number 6 among nations in 2009. On this scale, we place behind Iraq, Pakistan, Egypt, and Afghanistan, and we're just edged out by Sri Lanka, but we're ahead of Algeria, Malaysia, Bangladesh, and the 139 nations of the world that have abolished the death penalty in law or in practice. 139. It sounds familiar. It's because it's the number of exonerations from death row. And it's a number that we really need to remember as we consider and decide how slow off the mark we want to be in deciding to join 47 of the 48 nations of Europe, with only Belarus dragging its feet, including all 27 nations of the European Union, how late we want to be to the party hosted by Eleanor Roosevelt, who championed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in San Francisco over 60 years ago, declaring the essential right to life. Thank you very much for being here, and I'd love to hear what you think. So if your question is about after the fact, after the conviction, after someone has been convicted of a crime on an appeal or on a collateral attack, a post-conviction court process, I could answer in general terms, or I could ask, do states greatest expert on this subject who's in the room to actually answer the question. So, Michael, can I? Would you answer that question? Let me try to refocus just a little bit rather than speaking to the specifics of one case. I think that the general question that you raise is about raising issues that may be mitigating of the death sentence after the fact. So I will say that in a death prosecution, there are two trials. There is a guilt phase, and then there is a penalty phase. And there is the opportunity to present mitigating evidence there. In a general way, I would say, and Michael's going to either nod at me or shake his head, that if the adequate mitigating evidence is not presented at trial for one reason or another, because it wasn't available, because counsel was ineffective, because it wasn't known, because there wasn't enough money available to do investigation, then it may be possible to bring that mitigation up in a post-conviction context, but the bar is extraordinarily high at that point to get a reversal of a conviction or of a sentence and by presenting mitigation post-conviction. Is that fair? Okay, thank you. So let me make another general comment about that, which is sort of in one way we can go back to death is different. And, of course, scientific knowledge is evolving continually. I'm certainly, and the law is evolving. So it's only fairly recently that in the United States mental retardation is a disqualification from eligibility for the death penalty. But, you know, if we didn't have the death penalty, maybe all of those mentally retarded people who have already been executed could be saved. But death is different. Death is permanent. And when scientific knowledge and when education and when the law sort of catches up, then if someone's dead, it's too late. So, yes. Go ahead.
What is it about the collective psychology of the United States that makes us so much more willing to put people to death than virtually every other industrialized democracy?
What a good question. What do you think? What do you think? I mean, what do you think? Seriously.
I think it's probably a vestige of sort of our Puritan heritage that was buried eye for an eye, fire and brimstone. And I think that kind of Old Testament type religiosity.
Well, I actually think that that's part of it. I mean, I agree with you. If it's sort of like my mother, who is not a lawyer but is a scientist, at moments like this would say to me, and still says to me, if I knew that, I'd be in Stockholm getting the prize. You know, it's sort of the $64,000 question. I think that's part of it. You know, since the work that I do has to do with explaining Americans to Europeans and explaining Europe to Americans, which is, you know, sometimes a little tricky. One of the things that kind of works for me as in that is to talk about the United States as a teenage boy, where we're an adolescent nation. We are not fully mature. We have a great deal of creativity and energy and imagination and strength. And we have an enormous amount of disrespect for traditions that are older than ours and for our elders and for our parents, our figurative parents. And we and no one can tell us anything. So in terms of learning from the experiences of the rest of the world, that's sort of what works for me. I do think that we are we have more of that kind of religiosity, as you describe it, than Europe. And I think that we're stubborn as a people, and not quick to change our minds. So I think that there is a sort of that American independence thing comes with a dose of, I'm not going to change my mind no matter what the facts are, you know, sort of a George W. Bush kind of thing. But I certainly don't know for sure, but it's a great question. Yeah.
In my opinion, it was the death penalty issue that was used to remove Chief Justice Roseburg off the California Supreme Court. And I think ever since then,
well, I think that there is some truth in that, although I have let me just say one other thing about that. I think that it was certainly publicized. That was certainly the image in the popular press. I think that there were other things going on politically, including that she was not very friendly to business. And, you know, my perhaps cynical view of almost everything is, and maybe it's because I was born in Brooklyn, I'm not sure, but money talks, you know, and everything is a bottom line deal. And I as much as it was politically feasible and sort of dramatic to attack Rose Byrd and her colleagues for being against the death penalty, I think that there's an argument to be made that, in fact, their anti-business decisions might have even had more impact.
But the literature that I've read on this matter all says that that's part of the reason why politicians now, so they go up and they say, we are for the death penalty out of fear, they won't get elected.
I think that's exactly true. And, in fact, it's wrong, but it's true. I mean, they're mistaken. But you're exactly right. There has never been a downside to a politician being opposed to the death penalty. So they can say, I'm tough on crime. Was that completely unclear? The double negative. Okay. So there's an upside to saying, I'm tough on crime. I'm for the death penalty. And there's never been a perceived downside to saying, I'm tough on crime, I'm for the death penalty. The reality is there's actually, we know that people don't, it's not an important voting issue for people. And they in fact, people generally do not vote for or against a candidate because of that candidate's views on the death penalty. So you're right. It takes political courage and, you know, backbone, maybe something that we're lacking both in the legislature and perhaps on the bench. Yeah.
Okay. What exactly makes the death penalty
Great question. Many things. One thing I'll say about that is that part of the cost is not in the appeals. The California Constitution does require a direct appeal of every death sentence to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is 5 justices, Supreme Court of the State of California. It doesn't go, the death cases don't go to the courts of appeal and then possibly to the Supreme Court. They all go to the directly to the Supreme Court. But the cost, the added cost, is not only in the appeals. And that's something that you do sort of read and hear. They say they should just get rid of all those appeals and, you know, a bullet only costs a quarter and just kill them within 3 months. I mean, that's sort of the sort of tough on crime ignorant rhetoric. A good deal of the cost is at the trial level. So a death trial costs over $1 million more than an ordinary homicide trial. And those are costs that are borne by the county, not by the state. So, for example, for Alameda County, which is broke, you know, we have a lot of broke counties, right? That $1.1 or so million dollars extra to have a trial be a death trial comes out of your county budget. That's the same budget that funds the sheriff's department, your county hospital, your parks. All of the county functions come out of that same general county budget. And that's one cost that's at the local level where people, and this is a really important point because a lot of what we're doing in working politically against the death penalty in California is really a very grassroots city by city, neighborhood by neighborhood effort. Because if you live in Alameda County, there's actually a very strong coalition, the Alameda Coalition for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, and they show up at candidates' meetings. There, you have an election coming up for a district attorney. Go there. Go to those candidates. Go to the debates and ask those candidates how they justify whether they would use the death penalty and how they would justify that expense, that extraordinary expense coming out of your budget. And that's the strategy. This is really a people's campaign, I got to say. County by county, and Alameda County is a very important one. So that's one thing. There are 2 trials. There's the and that's more expensive because there's the penalty, the guilt phase and the penalty phase. There are more resources put on both sides. Most people who are tried for homicide are indigent, and their defense is paid for by the public. You get an extra lawyer, you get more money for investigation, the prosecution puts more money into it, there's more security, the housing is more expensive post-trial. So there are a lot of factors that go into it. And okay, is that enough?
I just say that
please. So those extra costs are being spent for all of these death, all 100 of those, all 10% of those prosecutions, and that's going to, those 100 death, expensive death prosecutions are going to wind up with less than 1 death sentence. So the costs are magnified in that way. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So this is I should have identified Michael. Michael Millman is the executive director of the California Appellate Project, which trains and supervises private counsel who do capital appeals, and that's why I'm so very deferential to his far superior knowledge. And so we have some experienced folks here. There is something called that's sort of, I guess, known in the trade as death qualification of jurors, potential jurors in a death case. And what that means essentially is that if a jury is being picked in a capital prosecution, basically, in order to be eligible to be on that jury, every person, every potential juror, the potential juror has to be basically in favor of the death penalty. If you're opposed to the death penalty, then you're not eligible to be on the jury. And one of the things that is known about death-qualified jurors is that not only are they more likely to rule in favor of decide in favor of the death penalty as opposed to permanent incarceration, they're more likely to find the defendant guilty. So the death qualification means that you have a jury that's biased in favor of guilt. So the whole process is tainted by that bias from the beginning. Is that what you were referring to? So, yes. Sir. Yes. Okay.
I think of two articles in the news recently which really spoke to me. One was just this past weekend, the New York Times had a magazine article about research on babies showing how they have an innate moral sense and even before they can talk, a need to see wrongdoers punished. And then there was this article about the man in China who attacked school children with a knife. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Reading that, there's part of me that said, way to go. And I think most people in this country share that feeling, and that's one of the reasons they support the death penalty, that at times it seems like the only proportionate punishment for someone who has violated all the norms of your society.
Yeah.
So I think one has to speak to that real psychological need people have to see appropriate punishment, and if that is a function of
well, I think you raise a number of really important questions. Certainly, there is a desire for revenge, and certainly families of many families of victims of homicides want revenge, and. One way of running society is to let them have it, and let them go off and pursue and kill the killer of their loved one, and we can call that we could call it vigilantism, or we could call it complete anarchy. It's not what we do. We have society to interpose a rule of law between the victim and the wrongdoer. So yes, there's a desire for revenge, but it's not the only thing, and it cannot be the controlling thing if we want to live in a civilized way, in some way that's not just anarchy. In terms of punishment, I couldn't agree more. And I guess I didn't talk much about punishment, but talking about safety, I could easily have been talking about punishment. I completely agree that we need to severely punish people who do terrible things. And I got to say that, you know, death in prison is no picnic, you know? I mean, it's a pretty severe punishment. As far as that, you know, sort of worst of the worst aspect of what you're talking about, the guy who, you know, is murdering school children, the crime is the worst of the worst. You know, it's tough because maybe you're right. You know, maybe the worst of the worst should be eligible for death. And then how do you manage the next step, which is who decides that? And by what standards? I mean, among the, by now, many death row exonerees that I know, there's one, you know, and I know three from Oklahoma, and I don't know, you know, most of the 139, but I know three from Oklahoma. And one of them, Curtis McCarty, was 22 when he went to death row. And he was convicted twice and sentenced to death three times for the same crime. And, you know, he spent his entire adult life until 43 on death row in Oklahoma. And it was sort of serendipity, kind of, that his exoneration, because what happened was there was a forensic officer of the state of Oklahoma whose results were attacked so many times, were so anomalous, the state did nothing, and finally somebody, and I honestly don't remember the details of the story, managed to get the FBI interested. So the FBI investigated this woman, and they found out that she had hidden evidence, falsified testimony, basically lied about the science. So they re-examined all these cases, and a number of them were reversed because it just wasn't true. So you've got an officer of the state, a highly respected scientist with, you know, like a PhD, you know, testifying on behalf of the state repeatedly, and people are being sentenced to death. Now, are those areas of science valid? I would say, yeah, probably. You know, you can do hair analysis, you can do DNA, you can do stuff. But what about this woman is lying about it? Who's going to decide if she's a reliable witness? Who's going to decide? Are you going to say, well, this guy, he was convicted twice and sentenced to death three times. How guilty do you have to be? Execute the guy. So it's easier to say the worst of the worst than to implement the worst of the worst. There are so many places for error. There are so many places where if the lawyer hadn't been paid by the hour paid a flat fee in a way that put the lawyer in a direct conflict of interest with his client, if there had been money for an investigator, if there had been psychological testing available, if we had known more, if this woman in the police lab in San Francisco hadn't been, you know, snorting all the coke that was supposed to be in evidence, if. And there are too many points of uncertainty to be killing people. So that's basically my answer to you.
I think we have time for one more question.
Okay, so the gentleman over here.
a kind of suicide option in connection with the abolition of the death penalty?
Well, people have a suicide option, but suicide by state, I would say, is not the right one. Well, not only is there a lot, I'll tell you another little story, not only is there a lot of effort that goes into it, also in Oklahoma there was, you know, a guy who's scheduled to be killed, he's the next guy, and he decides that he's gonna take a little bit of control back of his life, and everybody he knows there gives him all of their stored up, saved up pills, and he takes everything. And he loses consciousness, and they go in to get him, to bring him into the death chamber to kill him, and he's unconscious. So what do? They take him to the hospital, they pump his stomach, they bring him back, and then they take him back to the death chamber and they kill him. And that's a true story. You could read it in the New York Times. So, I mean, I think that basically, you know, my personal belief is that people have a right to take their own life. It's also my belief that people who are on death row are not in a really good decision-making frame of mind. They have no power, and I think a decision made by someone on death row, a decision of that kind made by someone on death row, a decision to abandon appeals, a decision to not cooperate with a lawyer, is not a decision that's made by a sound mind. That's my personal view. Patrick, thank you very much. Thank you all very much. Oh, so there's really fantastic literature over here, a number of reports. There's a report from the ACLU. There's a report from the Death Penalty Information Center on Smart on Crime about police chiefs interview, what police chiefs think is important, a report from California Crime Victims on Unsolved Homicides, information on all kinds of stuff. So I encourage you to please take it and email me with any questions. You can brag about belonging to Death Penalty Focus. There's still a sign-up sheet there and some information over here. Thanks a lot.